Me and my friend Milo.
If you're the parent of a young child or a child yourself, you might recognize this voice.
We're the best of friends.
That's 11-year-old Charlie Ibsen as the leapfrog toy Scout the Dog. Well, San Francisco Chronicle writer Peter Hartlob has made it his mission to track down the real people behind the voices of his children's toys. He calls this the Talking Toy Project, and Peter Hartlob joins us to talk about it. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
How did you start on this adventure to track down the voices behind your kids' toys?
I think it went way back. I remember probably 20 years ago when I found out that the voice of Bart Simpson was actually a grown woman. I started to get suspicious every time I heard an animated character. And then my children started getting talking toys as gifts. And, you know, they love the talking toys. If it was up to me, I would have just, you know, whittled all of their toys from logs in the backyard. I didn't want anything talking in my house except me and my wife and my kids. But they got the toys and they loved them, and that suspicion continued.
And you ultimately, starting with Scout the Dog, this green floppy-eared dog, track down the voice who's inside Scout, and you find it's Charlie Ibsen, 11 years old.
And I have always thought that they were all 45-year-old women. And then to find out that he was actually a kid was a surprise for me.
Well, Scout the Dog can be programmed to say your kid's name, favorite food or animal in Charlie's voice, which means he has to go in and record those names, right?
Yeah, and I went in and he was recording, I think, Rush and Dylan.
Let's listen. We have some audio from that recording session when he's recording these names.
All right, we're going to do Dylan, then we're going to do Rush. Ready?
Yep. Dylan?
Perfect. Nice to meet you.
Dylan?
That was the winner, Charlie.
Rush?
Good.
He's good at what he does.
Yeah, he was in one take, Charlie. They're all in awe of him. He's like a rock star when he walks into Leapfrog.
Well, Peter, you have tracked down the voice of Scout the Dog, so that's one checked off your list. Who else are you trying to find? What other voices inside your kids' toys?
The next one I've got is the Fridge Farm magnetic animal set, Tad the Frog, who I have located. That's going to be the next one that I do. She's in Los Angeles. I'm planning on a road trip.
Okay, now you've brought the Fridge Farm magnetic animal set there with you into the studio in San Francisco. Can we hear it?
Yes, here you go.
Hi, I'm Farmer Tad. Listen to my banjo.
Okay, so you're going to meet her. Who else is on your list?
I've got Iron Man.
I am Iron Man.
Oh, wow.
Repulse at last.
You think that's a real person behind there?
I do. I'm betting they don't look like Robert Downey Jr. it could be a woman. It could be anything.
Okay, so anybody else on your list of voices you need to find?
Yeah, this is the Radio Flyer Retro Rocket.
All systems go, Retro. We're looking good. 3, 2, 1, welcome!
I just envision this guy with huge deltoids and Retro Rocket, and I know I'm going to be just completely shocked when I find out who it really is.
And as someone who works in radio, let me tell you, you may be sorely disappointed.
Who knows? It could be anybody. That's what's part of the fun of this.
Well, Peter Hartlob, good luck on your quest. Sounds fun.
Thank you so much.
Peter Hartlob is the pop culture critic at the San Francisco Chronicle. He writes the parenting blog The Poop, and he's spending this year tracking down the voices behind his children's talking toys.
Me and my friend Milo. We like to do everything together. Let's jump up and down. Jump, jump, jump. Let's wag our tails. Wiggle, wiggle, waggle. Let's snuggle up. Snuggle, snuggle, snuggle. Me and my pal, Milo. We're the best of friends.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It doesn't take a royal wedding for wedding madness to take hold, though nuptials were the last thing on Miranda Kennedy's mind when she headed off to India nearly a decade ago, an aspiring foreign correspondent. In her 20s, she left behind a job and a man she loved, though was hardly ready to marry. That was before she discovered that as a single woman, she could not rent an apartment, because to landlords in Delhi, single meant loose.
it was pretty horrifying to drive around, you know, in rickshaws and be turned away, you know, have doors slammed in my face, literally, because I was on my own.
So you found yourself doing something, what, I'm guessing you never would have done before, which is you transformed your boyfriend back in New York into a husband.
Right.
Who happened to just not be there yet.
Yeah, well, the poor boyfriend back in New York.
You didn't tell him, though, because,
no,
you know.
No, that wouldn't have gone over very well.
Soon, Miranda Kennedy was ensconced in her own apartment and had a housekeeper, Radha. In her memoir, Sideways on a Scooter, she writes that Radha had a wedding on her mind, as does much of India.
Weddings are, in general, the biggest lifetime expense for Indians of all income groups. Middle-class Hindu weddings mean a guest list tipping into the thousands and 2 full weeks of religious rituals, parties, and dinners. In other words, lifelong debt. In today's India of conspicuous spending and Bollywood glitz, the richest grooms arrive at their weddings in helicopters. Their banquets feature extravagant flourishes such as spurting chocolate fountains. Indians spend an average of $32,000 on a wedding. That's $7,000 more than the average American spends, even though Indians earn only 10% of the American per capita income.
Radha, your housekeeper, spends her time worrying about her marriage-age daughter as soon as she hit, what, about 16?
Yeah, Radha started fretting about getting her daughter married off, and she went to her priest, and her priest found the perfect boy, perfect in every way, meaning his caste and religion and age matched Pushpa's.
So what happened?
So she married her daughter to this boy, which she was sure would guarantee her daughter lifelong happiness, and, you know, which didn't. But as far as Radha was concerned, it was her best chance at making her daughter's life better.
Next to Radha, there's another important woman in your life, and she's more a contemporary. Her name's Gita. She's a neighbor. But certainly at first glance, you would think she's really quite like you.
Yeah, yeah. She was my age and very independent, and my first sight of her was she had a pair of car keys dangling from her hand, and I was very impressed by that because most Indian women I knew, even middle-class ones, didn't drive themselves, and she, you know, occasionally wore miniskirts and went out to clubs and stuff. And yet, Gita was extremely traditional. She had no intention of having a love match, as she called it. She definitely was going to have an arranged marriage. And, you know, she had a lot of traditional expectations for herself.
Though she isn't 100% traditional, there was a mix there.
Right, yes. So there's lots of different types of arranged marriage in the new India. And the type that she shows is the type that millions of young women and men are choosing now, which is clumsily called love come arranged marriage in Indian English. So the easiest way to have these matches happen is through online portals, which are kind of like Match.com, except they're only about marriage. And it's normal for the parents to fill out those profiles and for them to then choose the boys who you might go meet. But in theory, in these kinds of arranged marriages, young people have a lot more input into their own choices of partners than they ever have before.
From Gita over to a yoga teacher that you know, all of them are in some way circling around issues of marriage. And at the very heart of this, for some of them, is the practice of paying a dowry. Dowries are illegal in India and have been for a long time.
They are, and yet in today's modern India, you know, where women have more independence than they ever have before, where they're more highly educated and where there's more of them in the workforce, dowry has increased.
Tell us about Usha, where the dowry loomed quite large in her case. She's the yoga instructor.
Well, for Usha, she was the youngest child in her family. Her parents were dead and her brothers were in charge of marrying her off, and they had actually spent all their savings on the other daughters. So there wasn't much dowry for her.
So there's this parade of really unsuitable boys and their unsuitable families.
Yeah.
There's this one moment where an entire family comes in and the women in that family, they have to check her feet.
Yeah. And Usha was horrified by this because she'd never heard of this tradition. I mean, no one has ever heard of this tradition. It was like this family's random village tradition. But because she was the marriage age girl, she had to put up with whatever the family wanted to do. And so the idea was if her two first toes were of equal length, that meant that she would listen to her husband. So luckily, or unluckily for Usha, her toes were the same length, and this cry went out amongst the women that the girl is good, and they promised that they would come back with an official proposal because this meant now that she was a desirable bride. And after they left, Usha looked at her brother kind of pleadingly, and he said, "Don't worry, they would be lucky to get you for free."
Miranda, thank you very much.
Thank you, Renee.
Miranda Kennedy's new memoir is called Sideways on a Scooter. She's now an editor here at NPR, and you can read an excerpt of her book at npr.org.
Morning Edition is directed by Van Williamson and Selena Simmons-Duffin. Our production staff includes Chris Benderev, Nishant Dahiya, Jess Gittner, Asma Khalid, Vince Pearson, Travis Larchuk, and Lindsay Totti.
With Ben Bergman and Sasha Woodruff here at NPR West. Our executive producer is Madalika Sicca.
The executive director of news programming is Ellen McDonnell, and our theme music was written by B.J. Lederman and arranged by Jim Pugh.
And this morning we offer 1,000 thanks to our technical director, Brian Jarbo. If you've been amazed by the sound of a voice from the far side of the world or from near your home in the past 5 years,
there is a good chance that that sound passed through Brian's steady, capable hands on the way to your radio. So join us in raising a coffee mug. I've got one here to Brian as he moves on to NPR's Tell Me More. He's a pro. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And raising my coffee mug to Brian, I'm Renee Montaigne.
The shuttle program is winding down, but space exploration is far from over. NASA has doled out millions to private companies to develop a kind of space taxi to the International Space Station. And for more about that and some other big space ambitions, we turn now to John Logsdon. He's a member of the NASA Advisory Council's Exploration Committee and the former director of the Space Policy Institute at George Washington University.
Good afternoon.
Well, let me ask you about some of the things that are in the works. And why don't we begin with the thing that we mentioned, the space taxi. And when I think about a taxi, I think of something that's yellow and has black and white checks on the side. I assume it won't look like that.
No, it won't. But it will almost certainly be a capsule, although one of the competing companies has a little glider that could land on a runway. It's a small thing like we used in the 60s and 70s, just a capsule, and only to transport crew, probably up to six or seven people, mm-hmm. up to the space station and back. Won't have all the capabilities of the shuttle. It is really just a transportation service, just a taxi.
When will we first see that? Is there a lag between the time when the space shuttle program ends and when you might see that capsule take flight?
Yeah, for the next few years after the shuttle stops flying, presumably in June, we will be dependent on the Russian Soyuz spacecraft to carry American astronauts to the space station. Hopefully by 2015 or 2016, these new systems will come online, be tested, and be ready to carry astronauts to the station.
Could you tick through some of the other things that are on the drawing board?
The current law of the land says that NASA shall develop a heavy lift, a big rocket, for deep space exploration, and a thing with a non-euphonious name called the multi-purpose crew vehicle, a vehicle to carry astronauts, probably a crew of four, to distant destinations. So it has to be set up so that they can have the life support for month-long and even longer journeys.
What will the astronauts be looking for? What are you hoping to explore and to discover with deep space flight?
I think the answer is different at different destinations. Asteroids are clues to the origin of the solar system. They're some of the primordial material out of which this solar system formed. So there's a lot of fascinating science to be done. And there are people who think that they are rich in resources that could be economically utilized, maybe not so much the near-Earth asteroids as the ones beyond Mars in the asteroid belt, where people say there are trillions of dollars of minerals embodied in them. To go back to the moon, I think it's both to you could put a radio telescopes on the back of the moon if you're searching for extrasolar planets, maybe searching for signals of extraterrestrial life. We only went to a few destinations, only six spots on the moon. We haven't explored that. There's interesting evidence that there's water, at least at the south pole of the moon, that could be used to support a scientific outpost. So we're not done with exploring the moon. And Mars, the issue is, was there ever or might there be now any kind of life form there? That's kind of the holy grail.
Will we see travel to Mars within our lifetime?
Depends on how old you are. We don't know how to go to Mars now. This is the sort of thing we have to learn step by step, of how to protect the crew, how to keep the crew able to do work once they get there. We've targeted sometime in the 2030s as a reasonable time frame, 2035, something like that, 25 years from now.
Now, I'm not going to try to guess your age, but I'm just from looking at you, assuming that you're of a generation where young people grew up dreaming of space flight. Is that hold true for young children today?
My first launch that I attended in person was Apollo 11, first mission to the moon. Nothing's going to get better than that. I took my 3.5-year-old grandson down for a shuttle launch last spring, and it had a remarkable impact on him. So at least he is going to grow up wanting to be an astronaut, wanting to go into space.
John Logsdon, thanks so much for coming in to talk to us.
My pleasure.
John Logsdon is a member of the NASA Advisory Council's Exploration Committee, and he's also the former director of the Space Policy Institute at George Washington University. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Michelle Norris.
I'm Melissa Block, and this being Friday, we welcome back to the studio our regular commentators E.J. Dionne of The Washington Post and David Brooks of The New York Times to review the week in politics. Welcome back to you both.
Thank you.
Good to see you.
I was ready to declare this a royal wedding-free zone, but I gather you both have things you'd like to say. We'll try to save a little time for that. But let's talk first about President Obama's reshuffling yesterday of his national security team. Assuming they are confirmed, Leon Panetta will move from the CIA to the Pentagon as Defense Secretary. General David Petraeus moves from being the top commander in Afghanistan to head the CIA. EJ, you first. What do these two men bring to their new roles, do you think, that might shape policy in any different way?
Well, Panetta's move to defense has widely been interpreted because of his budget background as a sign that the president is going to be looking for more defense cuts. And I think that makes sense. Panetta was very good at making friends in the CIA and creating a lot of loyalty to him, which is not always easy for an outsider to do with the CIA. And he's really going to have to bring the Pentagon along, I think, as the budget fights continue. General Petraeus has said over and over again that he doesn't want to run for president. It's been thought he'd run as a Republican. Working for Barack Obama is not exactly a way to run for the Republican nomination for president, so one can believe him. There's always some uneasiness in the CIA when someone from the military comes in, yet there have been successful heads of the CIA from there. I think it's going to be interesting to watch the relationship with the Pakistani intelligence. There may be some friction there. But I respect Petraeus for accepting this job, because if he has any political aspirations, this sure isn't coincident with them, unless we discover he's a Democrat.
David Brooks, what do you think? Any signal here about the future size of the military, the troop drawdown in Iraq and Afghanistan?
I don't think there's a signal. There are going to be budget cuts no matter who's the defense secretary. One of the things that, for example, my colleagues Mark Mazzetti and Eric Schmidt have been writing about is the merger between the intelligence services and the military. And this has happened when you're fighting the Soviet Union, the CIA does one sort of analysis and the military prepares for a certain sort of war. When you're fighting the Taliban, the CIA is much more involved in military affairs. So what's been happening on a whole series of levels is the intelligence community and the Defense Department have been merging. And this is a perfect example of how that merger has happened, disturbing people and the old guard in both buildings. And yet it's probably just an inevitable effect. The other thing is you will have Petraeus and Panetta at the table now when the president's making decisions about whether to go into a future Libya or something like that. And that will reconfirm, I think, his center or center-right inclinations on military action.
The national security changes had been largely expected. Let's talk about something that was much more of a surprise this week, and that was President Obama's decision to release his long-form birth certificate, confirming yet again that he was, in fact, born in Hawaii. There's been a lot of debate, of course, about whether this was a capitulation to the birther fringe, really dignifying that which shouldn't be dignified. David Brooks, did the president make the right choice?
I agree he made the right choice in putting out the long form itself. I wish he'd done it years or months ago, but I think that was absolutely right. Whether I would have myself gone out and given a press conference at the same time Donald Trump was giving a press conference and thereby creating a split screen, whether I would have complained about the aggravating debate going on in Washington, that I would not have done. I think
why not?
Well, because I think what we all have to do, there's really a two-class system in politics. There's the circus class and the serious class, if I can be pompous about it, and why not? and I think people in the serious class should just avoid the circus class. And the birthers are in the circus class, and just go on with the serious business that you were elected to do, and don't engage all that directly, because there's no way to come out unsullied.
EJ, you've written that it's insane that supposedly serious media are devoting so much time to this issue, yet here we are, supposedly serious and devoting time to this issue. Is there really a choice?
Well, I just don't believe David Brooks writes a New York Times column. I mean, just because his name is on the top of it, does that prove that he writes it? Can he give me proof right now that he writes his column? This has been absolutely ridiculous. I think Obama did the right thing both to put that out and to go out there to put an end to this, because Trump had just let loose an enormous amount of new quotes reporting on this and commentary on this, and I just thought it was time to stop it. And this has been very bad for our politics, and yes, it has racial overtones. It was partly about, is he one of us? And I think that's linked to the other stuff we want to talk about. We have made running for president and being president so difficult for anybody. When Obama, who was clearly born in the United States, 2 years later still has to do something like this, there's something defective in the way we're doing politics.
But in terms of the media critique, are you saying the media should really just be ignoring this?
Yeah, I think the standard for the media is something true or is it not true? And just because people are talking about it, I mean, I could declare that I am the greatest basketball player in human history and no respectable media would ever run that story. I think truth is what should matter to us.
Let's talk about the presidential campaign that's shaping up on the Republican side. One less Republican candidate for the presidency this week, Mississippi Governor Haley Barbour, bowing out, saying he doesn't have what he called the absolute fire in the belly. He would have had a lot of money behind him. David Brooks, surprised that he's not running?
No, I never thought he had much of a chance. My joke about him is that he was Michael Moore's version of a Republican nominee, in that he's a Southern white guy, a little hefty, worked as a lobbyist. And the other thing he faced, which I think he was honorable to face it seriously, was that given his backgrounds, given some of the things he said, there would be racial overtones to that campaign. And I think on top of everything else, that's not something he wanted to do. And so, it's sort of a loss. I never thought he had much of a chance. Those of us who hold out hope for Mitch Daniels had our hopes boosted a little because they are close friends, and one of the rumors was that he got out in order, and it certainly clears more ground for the Indiana governor.
So Haley Barbour bowing out. EJ, though, another possible Republican contender making his way back to Washington, John Huntsman, former Utah governor, leaving his post as President Obama's ambassador to China and returning today. Coincidentally, I'm sure, that he's giving commencement speeches coming up in South Carolina and New Hampshire, both early key primary states.
Yeah, I wonder why he's not in Idaho instead. I mean, Huntsman, this is going to be fascinating because the general view is, well, Huntsman worked for Obama. How can someone who worked for Barack Obama win a Republican primary in 2012? But I think Haley Barbour's withdrawal in the very uncertain state of this Republican primary leaves a lot of Republicans looking around for people. I don't know how Huntsman can pull it off or what exactly he says about Obama now that he is out of the administration. But if there was a year in which somebody coming from where he is might at least have some shot, it's this year, just because Republicans aren't really happy with their field.
And in the very brief time we have left, last words on the royal wedding. EJ, you first.
I'm a staunch Republican. That's with a small R. So I have no use for monarchies. But I was very moved when I was listening to NPR this morning and I heard her say, till death do us part. To me, this is a story about commitment, not royalty.
And David Brooks, very briefly.
Really nice gown. The monarchy is part of the identity of Great Britain, and as such, it's an important part of their culture.
Thanks to you both, E.J. Dionne and David Brooks. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This weekend, one of the biggest financial gatherings of the year is taking place in Omaha, Nebraska. It's been called the Woodstock of Capitalism, and it's the annual shareholders meeting of Berkshire Hathaway, the company run by Warren Buffett. To find out more about what's happening there this year, we've reached financial reporter Roger Lowenstein. Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's start with who is attending this meeting. That is, what is it about them and this meeting that makes it, you know, that makes them Buffett heads?
Well, Renee, every company in America has annual meetings, but most of them are, you know, really considered dead as doornails, and nobody goes to this one. Simply the shareholders of Berkshire Hathaway, some 40,000 people or so, are expected to go. They used to do it in the basement of a hotel, and then and now they take over a convention center. And as you said, it's the Woodstock of capitalism.
And as the Oracle of Omaha, people have long adored Warren Buffett. You've referred to him as the Prairie Sage. But some recent events at that company threaten his reputation. Remind us of what happened.
Yes, what happened recently, Berkshire acquired a company called Lubrizol, a chemical products company. And it came out in March, just as Berkshire was agreeing to acquire that company, that a senior executive of Buffett's, a man named David Sokol, had invested for himself $10 million in the stock before Berkshire acquired this company and actually made a personal profit for himself, Mr. Sokol did, of $3 million. And, you know, this seemed to violate and did violate Berkshire's conflict of interest policy, that the executive should be working towards the furtherance of Berkshire's, the company's interest, not to his personal interest.
Did it qualify as something illegal, like insider trading?
Well, you know, insider trading is a very murky issue, and the only answer to that right now is nobody knows. But the really important thing is that Buffett has always been famous for enforcing a higher standard. He said once, quite memorably to Congress, that he would make sure that investment bankers under him at the time would have to operate way, way, way from the line, meaning it wasn't just good enough to be a millimeter on the right side of lawfulness. You had to be way, way from the line.
So then, of course, this was compounded by how Warren Buffett reacted. Tell us about that.
Well, initially, his reaction was very disappointing. He issued a press release which said that he and Sokol had concluded that Sokol had not violated the law, which seemed really to duck the ethical point, the point that Buffett has always stressed, that you have to be way, way, way from the line. But just this week, Berkshire and Buffett came out with a much stronger statement in which they said that Sokol's behavior had clearly violated the conflict of interest policy of Berkshire. It said further that Sokol hadn't been candid with Buffett. So having disappointed his fans initially by not condemning Sokol, Buffett has gone a long way towards diffusing their concern.
So what is expected to happen at the meeting on the weekend?
Well, I think there'll be a ton of questions. There'll be shareholders, as always, from all over the world, most of the 50 states, India, China. And they're all going to be wanting to hear more about the David Sokol affair. Given Berkshire's recent press release, I'm not sure that there's much more that they're going to learn.
Although, do you think there will be a long-term fallout of the Sokol situation?
That's a very good question. You know, Buffett is 80. There's intense focus on who his successor might be. And I think his at least momentary slip in this case, David Sokol, after all, was rumored to be his chosen successor, is going to put added pressure on the board of Berkshire Hathaway to say, yes, we have an American icon running this company, but he needs supervision just as every other CEO does.
Roger Lowenstein is the author of Buffett, The Making of an American Capitalist. Thanks very much.
Thank you.